Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And this week I'm delighted to welcome back to the programme our good friend Anthony Rotuno, who has been on TMR many times before to discuss one thing or other. Things like, anyway, psychology, conspiracy theory, comedy, truth movement, advertising, propaganda, things like that. And it's always been a very interesting, engaging conversation, and I hope today will be no exception. Anthony is a teacher, blogger, thinker, originally from the UK, but now living and working in Madrid in Spain. Anthony, good to have you back on the programme.
Hi, Julian. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, actually. How's life treating you these days?
Yeah, pretty good. You didn't mention that I also talk about my private life, but that's only off mic. Julian's something of an agony uncle for me as well, but that's all off mic.
Well, I hope some of it will be on mic today, because I'm going to ask you, actually, because you've changed your address recently. You've got somewhere new to live. How is that all going?
Oh, it's going fine, yeah. I actually arrived in Spain in January 2014, and that was about the time we connected. So I moved into that flat then, and I just moved out about 2 weeks ago, and it's all good.
And, of course, you do a lot with music, and your band is very active these days. How's that all going?
Yeah, really good. I mean, I was very active as a musician in my 20s, but then I kind of didn't do anything for about 10 years, and then at the age of 39, I arrived in Spain and just happened to sort of frequent a place that had tons of musicians. And I recorded my first album at the age of 40. And then I recorded another one a year later. And it's been music all the way. Things can happen any time of your life, you know.
That's a good point. Yeah.
There was a guy who got picked up in his 60s, this guy called C6 Steve, who was found busking in New York at about the age of...
Oh, gosh, yes, I've seen him. Mm. Right. Oh, I didn't realise it was that late in life.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Anyway, yeah, it's going well, and teaching English. Got a couple of other irons in the fire, but they're not happening yet, so I'll tell you next time we talk.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we are actually going to be talking about a real subject today, you know, in our usual sort of half-planned, casual-ish kind of way. We're going to be talking about a documentary by a man who will be known, I should think, by probably the majority of people listening today, a man called Adam Curtis. He's produced many documentaries, of course, some of which I have watched and some of which you've watched and we both enjoyed. I think both of us want to mention The Power of Nightmares and The Century of Self, which we'll say something about in a little bit. I think they're both very much well worth watching, although I do have issues with certain aspects of his work, and no doubt some of that's going to come up in our conversation. But today we're going to be chatting about his 2016 documentary, which has the amazing title Hypernormalization. I'll say that again, hypernormalization. That's a fantastic word. And I say we're going to be sort of chatting around it, really, because we're not going to be attempting, at least I think this is what we've agreed on, we're not going to be attempting a kind of exhaustive analysis of this, but you know, rather giving our impressions, our reactions to various parts of it, because I mean, it is just so vast, it's unwieldy, I think, in many ways. So it's a focus, really, for our conversation. And the reason why we're doing this is because it covers a lot of very interesting subjects. I think we both agree that Adam Curtis probably tries to cover too much in this, and that his overall narrative is rather unconvincing, but there's a lot in here, and a lot that's worth discussing. So I thought what I would do is to give a few bits of basic information about this documentary so that everybody's on the same page with it. So please bear with me, Anthony, for a couple of minutes while I do this.
Okay.
So this is especially for anybody who's not seen the documentary. So Hypernormalization is written, directed, and narrated by Adam Curtis, produced for the BBC and came out in 2016. It is a massive 2 hours and 46 minutes long, so it's quite demanding to watch. And certainly if you're, as we've both done, you're to watch it and make notes, because that's even more demanding. Its basic thesis is that since the 1970s, governments, bankers, and technologists have increasingly retreated from the real world, because the real world is so complex and so unpredictable, and instead they have constructed an alternative fake world that's increasingly run by corporations and technocratic systems, while the politicians, the political classes, have become more and more effectively bureaucrats, sort of, you know, keeping the whole thing going, keeping it all stable. Really interesting hypothesis. Quite how true it is, we shall discuss from our own perspectives. And so this is all put under the heading of hypernormalization. Now, that's a word that comes from a book by a chap called Alexei Yurchak, who is an associate professor of anthropology at University of California, Berkeley. He grew up in the Soviet Union, and he has a book called Everything Was Forever Until It Was No More, The Last Soviet Generation, which he wrote in about 2005, 2006, something like that. And it's in that book that this chap uses the word hypernormalization to describe what was going on in the last decades of the Soviet Union. So Adam Curtis has used this particular word. So what Yurchak meant by it was something like that in the Soviet Union, the last days of the Soviet Union, everybody knew the system was failing, but in order to keep the whole thing afloat, both the citizens and the politicians were required to sort of keep up the pretense that everything was hunky-dory, everything was fine. And so this fakeness became publicly, anyway, this public fakeness became accepted publicly as a reality. That's the process. That's the state of mind that he refers to as hypernormalization. Fascinating idea. And the thesis in the film, of course, is that this process has been going on in the West as well, in its own way, since the last quarter of the 20th century. I say that's the hypothesis that Adam Curtis puts forward. So that's it in a nutshell. I think it's fascinating. I'm not sure he substantiates it through the documentary completely, but we'll come to that in a bit. So there's loads here to talk about. But I think before we get into the actual documentary itself, Anthony, I know that you want to say something about documentaries in general. So what are your thoughts about this genre of documentary as a vehicle for exploring truth, I suppose, especially in what we've discussed this before, what is the truth movement? But I think we know the kind of thing we're talking about here, especially in this sort of alternative area. But, generally, what's your view of documentaries as a genre?
Well, obviously, commercial documentaries have been around for a while, but since, I don't know when it started, say 2004, when this alt-media truth movement, whatever you want to call it, but the thing that we talk about a lot, documentaries were a huge part of it. One of the ones, just to throw one out there, would be Zeitgeist, the Zeitgeist series. And I've actually met Peter Joseph, and I quite warmed to him. But I think I remember watching Zeitgeist, and people were saying, oh, it's a great film and everything. And he has a very authoritative voice. He has a kind of voice that you like listening to. And it's the kind of voice where you think, this is an intelligent person, that they're probably telling me the truth. Yeah. And so I think it's almost like a rite of passage in alternative media to watch Alex Jones documentaries and, 9/11 Press for Truth and all that kind of thing.
Loose change. Yeah, but I'm not sure that Alex Jones has quite the same tone. But
no, that's a different. He's got more of a confident tone. Yep. Pete Joseph is a bit more professorial, perhaps. But all I was really going to say is that when you are involved in that and you're watching these documentaries which are supposedly giving you the truth, you're not really questioning them, which is effectively what you're saying that the quote-unquote sheeple are not doing. Yes. And I kind of got a bit caught out with that. So having been in this sort of scene for over 10 years now, it's interesting to watch documentaries again a few years later and see the ones that hold up. And just to throw one out there, that The Corporation, which is a Canadian documentary, I think that one really holds up. But other ones, they don't really. And you realize that they're employing a certain type of music, as Adam Curtis does, as we'll get to. And they're chucking a lot of information at you. Not all of it holds up. So all I'd really say is that documentaries, the fact that they're supposedly based on facts is sometimes a bit of a misnomer. And of course, we both know that, you can often get a lot more truth out through fiction. Just to give you an example, the film They Live, which we've talked about, where there's a guy who finds some sunglasses and he puts the sunglasses on, and all the signs, when he puts the sunglasses on, they all say obey, consume. It's offering you the truth, but then you put it in a piece of fiction and you're not offering it up as a truth. You're offering it up as a piece of art. So I'd just say a bit cautionary, really.
Yes, and I want to echo that, really. I think the thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that it's narrative, which is so powerful, and we need narratives to make sense of the world. These documentaries essentially feed you a narrative. They will have many facts in there, but they will embed those facts in a narrative. I'm going to use that word narrative throughout this, of course, because it's such a useful word. And it's very easy to be swept along with the narrative that is fed to you, because you don't have, in a documentary, you don't really have the space to consider carefully the alternative. Well, you don't get footnotes, do you, in a documentary to look them up, and you're swept along from one scene to the next. I'm not against, obviously, narrative. That is the way we think. there is a danger in there, isn't there, that you can get swept along.
Yeah.
As you say, with the music and the images and the juxtapositions of scenes and quotes out of context. And it's quite easy to fall into something that could be false. But it's a very powerful medium. We just need to be cautious of it.
Yeah, I suppose the argument for the music and that would be that you've got to try to entertain as well.
Yes.
If you're going to make a dry documentary, you may as well just read a book. You know, you've got to utilize the fact that it's visual to add entertainment to it. But I'd just say for anyone who's maybe just getting involved in the alternative media, just be a bit cautious, because you might be having the same games played against you as you might find in the mainstream. That's all.
Yes. I think for anybody making documentaries, there's a burden of responsibility, huge burden of responsibility, to be truthful and to be careful in what you're doing and not try to gain people's attention in an inappropriate way, because you really have got a very powerful tool in your hands.
Yeah, I mean, I've chickened out of starting my own podcast, and I mean, I've never thought about making a documentary. I'm sure I could. You can make one with a phone nowadays, but I've always shied away, you know, and I admire yourself and other people for making podcasts, but I've always just been too afraid, because I don't want to find out 6 months down the line that the person I interviewed, whoever, is like a charlatan or something. But this documentary we're going to talk about, I used to live in Southeast Asia, and if this was this documentary would be, is a city, it would be in Southeast Asia, because it's so sprawling. I'm already exhausted thinking about it.
Absolutely is.
Yes. I'm only kidding. We're going to do it justice.
We are indeed. And we're going to be we already have been, but I think we're going to continue to be quite critical of Adam Curtis in this conversation, sort of lay into him a bit. But I mean, just to be clear, I think we both think this, that some of his work that we've seen, The Century of Self in particular, The Power of Nightmares in particular, I find them very, very interesting. I mean, I was disappointed that he only went so far in The Power of Nightmares when it came to 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
You'll probably want to say this as well, but I thought it was really helpful in identifying Al-Qaeda as a propaganda construct by the West, you know, in the sense of a coherent organization with a leader and clear organizational purpose with sleeper cells and all that sort of thing ready to strike the world. But I thought it was disappointing that really he still accepted the official line of 9/11, you know, that it was essentially a jihadist terror attack without any significant US stroke Western organization support at all. You know, didn't really question that. So I was a bit disappointed with that. But I thought a lot of what was said other than that was really very interesting and powerful.
Yeah, I suppose the alternative argument, again, I don't mean to keep playing devil's advocate, but I suppose he'd say that he might discredit his old documentary with that, you know.
Yes.
Whatever his private views on 9/11 are, I suppose the argument is always so many people are just going to completely dismiss you if you mention that, you know, and I'm sure it's not the BBC's interests.
No, I mean, we've talked about that sort of thing before, haven't we, where we've mentioned that perhaps he's in the same sort of mould as Noam Chomsky on that one. I get the impression, I know not everybody agrees with this, but I get the impression that Noam Chomsky might well have his doubts about events such as 9/11, but chooses not to express them for exactly the reasons that you've mentioned.
Yeah.
That he can get his job done quite satisfactorily without challenging such things. He almost says that. He's been asked questions about it, and his reaction will be, well, I don't think it matters. Because his basic point about, you know, the US war machine, etc., he can make anyway without that. And I sort of see what he means, but it's disappointing. So I wonder whether Curtis is coming from the same position. I don't know.
I mean, maybe, yeah.
Or maybe he just didn't even see it. Maybe he cannot see the world that way. Maybe it's that.
Yeah. Well, I think Chomsky would probably say that, you know, the American war machine is something that's ongoing. So it's easier to get to the truth because it's ongoing rather than being a single event of, sure, you know, 17 years ago.
That as well, yeah.
Yeah, and he might even say, I mean, again, you'd never really be able to say this on mainstream TV, but if you actually look at body count, then being anti-war or questioning a foreign policy might even be considered more important if you look at it as sheer body count, because it is a single event. Yes, it's a huge event, but I don't know. I mean, yeah, of course, Adam Curtis's documentaries are BBC produced, so I don't know how much influence they have on whether they give him final edit and everything. I mean, who knows?
Did you want to say anything about The Century of Self? I mentioned Power of Nightmares. But,
I mean, just a few bits about it, just really to recommend it. I mean, it's I think it's I think it's actually technically a series, isn't it? It's something like 3 or 4 hours.
I think so.
Actually, to be honest, by giving him some advice, I'd have said, why didn't you make hypernormalization into a series rather than making us have to watch it in one sitting? But anyway.
The irony is we're actually recommending mostly all these other things rather than hypernormalization. Yeah. But I'll go.
Now, listeners, stick with us. We've got plenty of good things to say about this film.
Yeah.
Century of the Self, I mean, the basic thesis is that humans are irrational and are governed by their subconscious fears and desires. And Bernays, we've talked about before, is a nephew of Sigmund Freud. And he used some of Freud's ideas to influence things. People will know the story about the debutantes, that he got women smoking by persuading some debutantes at an Easter Day parade, I think it was, to hold up their cigarettes as torches of freedom, and someone took a picture of it. And the number of women smoking went up exponentially from there on in. Yeah, and then he was involved in the Guatemalan coup in 1954. But I'll let people research that for themselves. But just say he was very interested. A couple of other bits. I mean, he talks about the 60s and the anti-war protests. And what I found very interesting was that the ideas of the alternative media were very much prevalent then. The idea of keeping the masses docile while, you know, we fight an unjustified war. And, of course, we saw that years later in Iraq. I think he mentioned, again, people retreating. He seems to have a thing about, he likes talking about people retreating.
Yes.
And how people try to change themselves rather than changing the system. And then he goes on to the 80s. And the more I look at sort of geopolitics of modern times, the more the 80s seems like a huge decade, because Reagan and Thatcher came together in America and Britain. And they were very crafty, because they said, well, no one trusts politicians, so we're going to say less government and more business. So they started all these massive deregulation agenda, which still permeates to this day. And then the conclusion of the film is, we are the slaves of our own desires, so we're not free. Individual freedom comes from not having too many desires and not attaching to things such as products. And I could tell you that, you know, I've gone through that process myself, and he's dead right about that. When you stop watching TV and you stop paying any attention to advertising, the amount of stuff you buy goes down amazingly. And you start to realize how you're bombarded with opinions. But I definitely recommend that one.
Yeah, so we're recommending both of those, and indeed the one we're going to talk about. Actually, we did talk quite a lot about that, didn't we, when we chatted about advertising, about lifestyle and advertising. So I will direct listeners back to that particular conversation and all the conversations we've had with Anthony. Indeed, what about his style, Curtis's style? I mean, my thoughts are, really, a lot of it centers in his authoritative voice. He's very calm. He's very sort of rational sounding, very knowledgeable sounding, in fact. I think that's probably the key element in his style. But there are lots of other things. We've mentioned the use of music. He very often has an ironic use of music, doesn't he? Where there's a scene which shows you one thing, where the music perhaps carries the mood of a message that's already been mentioned, but it carries it across something that seems on the surface quite inappropriate. But of course, that's very powerful. And I suppose a similar kind of technique, juxtaposing images which are very contradictory to each other. I'm sure you will remember the one in this film we're going to discuss where he's got a load of women doing a workout, and it cuts to, you know, a blood-strewn floor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is very disturbing, but actually fits the theme that he's talking about of the superficiality of the culture when the reality is so horrendous. Any other thoughts about his style? Lots of very powerful techniques he uses.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I definitely echo all that. Yeah, he has an authoritative voice. It's sort of slightly irritating way of just repeating certain phrases, the way he says, he'll say, and they thought this and they thought that. What they didn't realize was that, and it's, I mean, it's not bad, it's fine, but it just seems a bit slightly contrived sometimes.
Especially in such a long documentary, you do tend to pick up on it, don't you?
Yeah.
The overgeneralizations, particularly. Everyone thought this.
Yeah.
Or a particular group is responsible for this. A particular individual seems to be key to this. And you're thinking, I'm sure the reality was much more complex than that. But, of course, that wouldn't make a good piece of entertainment.
Yeah, I like the music. I like, I can't remember which bit it was, but he uses a sort of swirly music. I mean, that's been used a lot in truth documentaries, because it gives the listener or the viewer, an idea that something is not quite right. And swirly music is very good for that. I like he uses a little bit of piano music. I don't know where he gets it necessarily from, actually. I don't know what his sources are. Presumably it's stuff that's already out there.
Well, I picked up on one piece, which was the Tarantulilla Symphony by Olivier Messiaen, which is a rather spooky sort of orchestral piece. Absolutely fantastic piece. And he uses it very effectively in the movie. I did pick up on that one.
What part did he use it? What was he?
I've made a note of it. I would have to search my notes here.
Okay. Well, what do you think it was conveying?
Oh, right. It was to do with Henry Kissinger and the double crossing of Assad Sr. In Kissinger's desire to destabilize the Middle East.
Okay.
It was used then, and the only thing I can get from using that is that Tarantulilla was to do with the play of the gods. That was the idea. That was the sort of image behind it, creating a cosmos by sort of divine play. So maybe it was the play of the little gods, you know? The world changes kind of thing. I don't know. But it worked. I think just musically it seemed to work.
Yeah, I noticed he uses echo as well, and echo definitely gives an ominous sense. But, you know, I just say, again, with documentaries, the problem is that a very good film with a skewed message is very bad in a way. So the fact that he's using music effectively could be a minus point if he's not conveying an accurate point.
Yes.
And, of course, his style has been spoofed.
That's right.
I don't know if we'd be able to provide a link.
It has indeed. Adam Curtis's documentary style has indeed been spoofed very, very effectively, I think. And perhaps we can hear the audio from that. So this is from Ben Woodham's YouTube channel in a video called The Loving Trap. And what he says about it there is, quote, in a landmark new documentary produced for YouTube, Adam Curtis has not examined his career and laid bare his style in the light of some confused academic papers he stumbled across on the internet. Instead, I have plundered various video archives and ripped him off up, down, left, right, and back again. Unquote. So let's hear this. It's only a few minutes long, but I think it hits the spot in many ways.
This is a short film about a documentary filmmaker who made critically lauded programs for the BBC, and about how, along the way, he proved that style always triumphs over substance.
Wherever you find them, friendly people, gracious customs, both mean true hospitality today, tomorrow, and all through the years to come.
In 1992, a strange and brilliant That's Life researcher with a Skinny Puppy CD embarked upon a career of producing documentaries about how ideas can spark social movements. Adam Curtis believed that 200,000 Guardian readers watching BBC Two could change the world. But this was a fantasy. In fact, he had created the television equivalent of a drunken late-night Wikipedia binge with pretension to narrative coherence. Combining archived documentary material with interviews, Curtis filled in the gaps by vomiting grainy library footage onto the screen to a soundtrack of Brian Eno and Nine Inch Nails. He had discovered that it did not matter what footage he used, so long as he changed the shot so bewilderingly fast that the audience didn't notice the chasm between argument and conclusion. This was especially effective when he simply cut the music mid-bar. And as a result, Sabo and Mbeki were swept to power at the next general election. Meanwhile, in America, a strange and brilliant cameraman was shooting stock footage of Death Valley, California. Curtis implied that this was somehow relevant to the labyrinthine argument he was constructing. His audience believed that it would turn out to be of crucial significance. But this was a fantasy. Curtis never returned to Death Valley, or the cameraman. He had discovered that they did not matter, because 5 minutes later, his audience had simply forgotten about them. But this did not matter, because Curtis spoke with such an impeccable, authoritative BBC manner that the audience took even gross generalizations and unsupported value judgments to be the absolute truth. They simply went along with it. And thanks to Adam Curtis, Brian Eno never had to work again.
It's kind of just making fun of Adam Curtis, but I think he's pretty good. But I would say to him, you know, break your stuff up into parts, because it gets slightly irritating after a while. I've got to be honest.
Well, there's one last thought that I want. It's not so much to do with style, I suppose, as approach. Mm. I've already touched on it, but I will mention it again because I think he only goes so far with his criticisms, and this does come out in this documentary as well. He consistently accuses the West of lying, cheating, double-crossing, etc. But when it comes to false flags, that's what he generally avoids. He tends to interpret along the lines of opportunism. Something happens and then, okay, say the US will, you know, the Pentagon will use that as an opportunity to do something with regard to foreign policy, etc. Mm. Not that it might have been set up that way.
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff he says is, you know, as I said, for a BBC, I mean, I guess the BBC have realised that people have woken up a little bit and that they have to include slightly more controversial sort of political commentary. But I think it's a bit later where he talks about Iraq invaded Iran with American bombs or British bombs. I can't remember. But from the West. That's the kind of thing that, I mean, most people probably know, but you don't always expect to see it said so brazenly. No. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot to recommend him in that respect. I totally agree.
Yeah, so yeah, he'll chuck stuff in, and that's why if you don't take this film as a whole and you just take nuggets from it and maybe use it to sort of do your own research or you know, it kind of works in that sense. I just wasn't convinced.
It does. And I think talking about Colonel Gaddafi, that was a very strong part of the film, I think.
Mm.
He made interesting points about Gaddafi himself, but also about the West's manipulation of Gaddafi, which I think was fascinating.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's an enemy, and then he's a friend, and then he's an enemy again. You know, within within half an hour of this documentary.
Yeah, so that was really interesting. I did have a quote here of an extremely critical review of hypernormalization. I don't know now whether to include it because we've been, well, certainly I've been very critical so far, but I'll just read this paragraph.
Okay.
So this is David Jenkins. This is not the former Bishop of Durham. No, it can't be because he died before 2016. Writing in Little White Lies website, 2016, a piece called The Dirty Tricks and Shady Tactics of Adam Curtis in his sprawling new work for the BBC, Hypernormalization.
Mm.
Adam Curtis reveals his limited range as a filmmaker. So this is the quote. His latest work, Hypernormalization, is a hulking beast, an angular info dump, which I like that actually, an angular info dump. Well, you know, that could be seen as positive. It is an info dump, which purports to pinpoint a moment where global society took an abrupt shift towards a moral abyss. It's a constantly compelling roundelay of political tidbits presented as fragments of a larger, vaguely unfathomable puzzle. Yet with this new film, as with his previous one, Bitter Lake, Curtis has self-consciously or otherwise fallen foul to hubris. The pieces all just about fit together, but the image they produce is blurred and indistinct. He knows that as long as he frames himself in a position of authority, he can say anything he likes and will swallow it whole. He seldom resorts to qualification. For him, or perhaps for the purpose of his films, history is a finite continuum where events either happened or they didn't happen. There is no dual perspective. Plus, it would be dramatically counterproductive to introduce qualification. He often talks about the people and everyone and politicians and bankers. That's the end of the quote there. It's pretty hard-hitting, but there's a lot of truth in what's said there.
Yeah, that's kind of what we're saying in about 30 seconds. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. But, you know, it has to be said, it is an info dump. There's an awful lot in there. It does produce an image. It's a bit blurred and indistinct. It is a vaguely unfathomable puzzle, but it is a puzzle. And, you know, history is a puzzle. Life is a puzzle. So it's an interesting one to look at.
Yeah.
So should we go for it? Shall we drop into this? And
yeah.
We need to look at the introduction first. Now, the podcaster Chris Ryan made a lot of this intro. I think it was a very wise thing to do, to concentrate on the intro, because it's the whole thing in a nutshell, in a way.
Mm.
Well, now, how about I read the first words of the documentary itself, and I invite you to comment upon it.
Okay.
What do you reckon?
Yeah, sure, yeah. Let's do it.
All right, so I'll try and put on my Adam Curtis voice. We live in a strange time. Extraordinary events keep happening that undermine the stability of our world. Suicide bombs, waves of refugees, Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, even Brexit. Yet those in control seem unable to deal with them, and no one has any vision of a different or a better kind of future. End quote.
Mm.
Okay, what's good and what's bad about that, eh?
All right, well, this is me and Chris Ryan. His podcast, Tangentially Speaking, I'd like to recommend as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did this review and he said, I've only reviewed the intro. I only watched the first 5 minutes of this film. And you're thinking, well, hang on a minute. Shouldn't you watch the other 9 hours or however long it is? Well, first of all, yeah, we live in a strange time of suicide bombs, refugees, Putin, Trump, and even Brexit. I mean, he's lumping suicide bombs together with Brexit. I mean, I'm not sure what the connection there is.
They're just strange things, I suppose. But I was thinking, can't you pick other times to say that's strange? I mean, wasn't 1939 to 1945 strange?
Yeah.
You know, wasn't the 1914-18 war strange? I mean, it seems a bit kind of arbitrary, really.
Yeah, and I think you could almost always say we live in strange times. Yeah. It's the same as thinking, you know, we talk about the fast pace in the modern world nowadays. Well, I mean, I've always been a student of the Titanic story, not the Leonardo DiCaprio, the actual story. And when there was a 100th anniversary, I got these newspapers, reprints of the newspapers, and they were talking about the fast pace in the modern world. So I think similarly, people probably think every time is strange. But like you say, you know, wartime was much stranger. Yeah, just lumping things together. And I mean, it's that quote that you gave. I mean, how long did that take to say? But there's a hell of a lot in it. But it just goes by, you know, and then he's on to something else. And I mean, nobody has any vision of a better future. I mean, it's a bit of an insult to activist groups. And
absolutely. Chris Ryan was very cross about that one, clearly, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
And rightly so.
Like I say, I'm somewhat parroting. I'm giving him the credit for a lot of this. But people have planned alternative societies, books, films. I mean, this is... Say nobody has any vision of a better future. That's ridiculous. Whether you're able to actually get that happening, you know.
Well, how about a world without so many wars? How about without Trident? You know, how about without NATO? I mean, they're all visions of a possible future. I can easily envisage those, you know, just stop funding them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And as for extraordinary events, you could pick just a slightly different era and say, extraordinary events, IRA bombs, famine in Africa, Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan... Even the fall of the Soviet Union. Mm. You know, it's easy to do. Each little pocket of time seems extraordinary in its own way.
Yeah, I mean, the 60s as well. Yeah. Late 60s was an incredible time.
So it's a bit artificial, isn't it? It's a bit artificial and over the top.
Yeah, and I think there's an agenda there. When you're talking about suicide bombs along with Putin, Trump and Brexit in the same breath almost, I mean, that's going to have a subconscious effect. I mean, that's another thing about documentaries. There's lots of subliminals and things have a subconscious effect, intentionally or otherwise.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to the suicide bombing thing because it's a big theme within the movie, which I personally think sits rather uncomfortably. I'm not wholly convinced by its place in the narrative to the extent to which it is stressed.
I won't comment now.
Okay, let's continue with this. The quote carries on. Quote, as this fake world grew... All of us went along with it because the simplicity was reassuring. The counterculture actually became part of the trickery because they too had retreated. Retreated, there's that word, into the make-believe world, which is why their opposition has no effect and nothing ever changes.
Yeah. There's so much in just that,
It is,
Just tell me the first bit again.
All of us went along with it.
Yeah, I mean, okay, all of us.
Because the simplicity was reassuring.
I think he's on to something, not all of us, but I think we've talked before about, it always sounds terribly patronizing, like we know things that other people don't, but Chomsky and others have talked about there's 80% of the public do more or less go along with anything. You can argue that number. A certain number of people went along with it because it's easier, and they go along with a lot of things because they're easier.
But not all of us.
No.
All of us went along with it.
All of us went along with it. Everyone except me and you, Julian, actually.
And Adam Curtis.
And Adam Curtis. And Russell Brand.
Actually, there is a sense of that, isn't there? That somehow Adam Curtis knows what it's all about, and kind of he's the only person who really does, because everybody thought it except him. Oh, I don't know. I suppose he said all of us, so it presumes it includes him. I don't know.
Well, I think Chris Ryan, actually, because he's American, when they hear a sort of posh English voice, and Adam Curtis is fairly, I don't know, would you call him posh? Probably middle class. He's from Kent, which is a sort of bastion of middle class England.
He's Oxford educated, though.
Yeah, right. I think to some Americans, a sort of posh English accent sounds faintly absurd. It's sort of a little bit quaint. Bill Hicks used to love making fun of that, yeah.
Yeah, I think, well, I fall into that one as well, so I can't say too much, can I?
Oh, dear, yeah.
People love my accent, you know.
I like your accent. It's great, yeah. You're not claiming that you know the truth and no one else does, are you?
No, certainly not.
Oh, hopefully.
Yeah, that's all right. I shan't be making any documentaries either.
What was the other bit? We all went along with it.
The counterculture actually became part of the trickery because they too had retreated into the make-believe world.
Counterculture became
Which is why that opposition has no effect and nothing ever changes.
Again, I mean, the last bit, their opposition had no effect. I mean, Chris Ryan talked about apartheid, reduction of female genital mutilation. Again, like activist groups, I mean, the one I always talk about is the water wars in Bolivia. Have you ever heard about that?
I think you told me before about it, actually.
A brilliantly named place called Cochabamba. And it was where Bechtel came in and were trying to privatize the water supply. And they were actually stopping poor people gathering rainwater. And the people just said, no. You know, I don't know how big the town is, the city, but, you know. And, I mean, all the civil rights, you know, Nina Simone, who's a musical hero of mine, Martin Luther King, all that. I mean, to say that it had no effect and, you know, I mean, it's just... That bit is pretty scandalous.
Absolutely. And let's speak in a positive sense about Noam Chomsky, that this is one of the things he points out, that a huge number of things actually were achieved in the 20th century in this respect.
Mm.
Things did actually get better for a lot of people. He would argue a lot of that is being gradually undone.
Mm.
But, you know, just to say that nothing ever changes is just clearly false.
Yeah, that's a bit maddening to kind of hear that, really.
It is, really. Yeah. Okay, this is the end of the quote here. But this retreat into a dream world allows dark and destructive forces to fester and grow outside, I think he means outside of the dream, forces that are now returning to pierce the fragile surface of our carefully constructed fake world. And I took from that that he's basically saying denial is a reality and it's not helpful. And that's a good point. If we're going to be tempted to live our rather surface lives, then yeah, of course, evils are going to gather apace and, you know, we become, what's that great quote? To do nothing is to be complicit in evils or something like that.
Yeah. Oh, we should find that. Should we find that?
I've got Edmund Burke going around in my head, but I don't know whether it is. Oh, it's disputed. Ah,
yeah.
All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. So this is dispute, according to Wikipedia here. It's probably the most quoted statement attributed to Burke. An extraordinary number of variants of it exist, but all without any definite original source.
Yeah, okay.
They closely resemble remarks known to have been made by the utilitarian philosopher John Stuart Mill. Bad men need nothing more to compass their ends than that good men should look on and do nothing.
Yeah. So there's lots of variations of the same one.
Yes, yes. Oh, well, that idea anyway.
Yeah.
So I think he basically makes that point. I think that is a good point.
So the idea that no action is a negative action. Mm. As with a lot of this, there's kernels of truth in a sweeping statement.
Yeah.
Can you just read it one more time? Sorry.
Yeah, sure. But this retreat into a dream world allows dark and destructive forces to fester and grow outside of the dream. Forces that are now returning to pierce the fragile surface of our carefully constructed fake world.
Well, I think the fake world, of course, you could equate that to the virtual world, you know, the internet, and the idea that, you know, with virtual reality, almost anything can be almost real. It's a sort of world just outside reality, really.
I agree, but I think he equivocates on this. I think he exploits the fact that we consider the internet world to be fake, virtual, but therefore, in some ways, misinterprets it because the internet is real and it can produce real effects in the real world. So just to call it fake or consider it fake is to misunderstand it to some extent. And I think he plays with that deliberately, just in order to make it fit his thesis.
Yeah, the retreat part of it, as far as I look at it, and I'm not saying that's what he's saying, but I think it's the more narcissistic side of kind of retreating into your own world.
Mm.
You know, posting on social media for the dopamine rush. You know, smartphones for me, I mean, they're just, if they are planned to be a distraction tool, I mean, it's genius because, yeah, there's a small proportion using them, you know, for activist purposes or to spread intelligent conversation. But, you know, I mean, I'm something of a student of this and smartphone technology and things like that, it does really make people retreat into their world. I'm not sure how much of what they're posting on social media is particularly relevant or helpful.
Well, he does explore this in the documentary, doesn't he? The extent to which digital technologies can be and have been liberating and the extent to which that liberation has been subverted and has turned out to be disappointing, that comes very much into the narrative.
Well, I mean, way back when we talked about changing the discourse, you know, 4 years ago, the point I was trying to make then, the sort of realization I've made, is that the majority of conversations at that time, I was talking about, you know, verbal conversations, are generally about nothing particular. There's not much depth to them, you know. And I was making my own sweeping statement, but again, I did work with activist groups in London. We did a hell of a lot of meeting the public and getting a pretty good idea of what the average person, what they knew, what their discourse was about. So if you just multiply all that, then logic would tell you that most of the traffic on social media is going to be fairly inane as well, because why would it suddenly be different? You know, it's the same people having another platform to express it. So I think this retreat into the sort of narcissistic world of social media, I think I would agree with that.
Okay.
You know, so there's kernels of truth. And yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah, let's get back on track then. The first section is called 1975. Mm. He has two cities in 1975, New York and Damascus.
Yep.
Now, quite why he chooses those, we'll discuss, I guess. So with New York, he begins with the narrative of a world without politics, kind of banking technocracy is the idea that's brought in. Or is it a word he doesn't actually use at this point? He does use it later in the documentary. So the idea was that New York was in massive debt in the mid-70s. The banks gave up on loaning to the city. The bankers then started running the city with austerity, so that's very topical. And the situation became that the logic of the market then ran the city. Now, he says no one complained. There was no collective person. That's right. And so he says that people turned inward towards individualism, towards the arts, music, sort of change the inside of people rather than to try to change the world. Okay, interesting idea. And then we have this funny sort of excursus on Donald Trump, because he brings Trump in a number of times during the movie. And it always feels rather artificial to me. It's as if it's made just before Trump, you know, is successful in his presidential campaign. And he's got to get Trump in there. And so I don't know, but I get the impression that it might have been almost made. And then he went back through putting Trump in. I don't know. But we see that Trump bought up a lot of derelict properties in New York to transform them into luxury apartments, and apparently negotiated the biggest tax break in history, so we're told. Mm. And the banks were quite willing to help him.
Did they all go along with it?
Sorry?
All of them.
Oh, all of them. Yeah, no, the banks. Sorry, aping. Yes, you're right. All the banks.
Yes. I was aping Mr. Curtin. Yes, no. Sorry.
All right, so the idea was that he would therefore transform the city into one for the rich. So he sort of fits in there quite well, but I can't quite believe that he's the only. Again, why New York and why Trump? And I don't know. And then it shifts to Damascus, so a long way away. And the narrative here is about geopolitical instability. And we have Henry Kissinger and the chap in charge of Syria at the time, which was Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current Bashar al-Assad. And both these individuals are introduced as being ruthless statespersons in their own ways. Assad was ruthless because he wanted Middle Eastern stability. Kissinger was ruthless because he was still involved in effectively the Cold War. They were both ruthless for stability. So Kissinger wanted a new world system, but growing out of the Cold War, balance of power. So he wanted to confront Syria and indeed to destabilize Arab countries generally in a kind of divide and conquer sort of way. And he double-crossed Assad. Mm. Then Assad retreated into a big palace and was bent on revenge against the US. So this sort of trying to manage a powder keg is the sort of picture that we have here. What do you think about that first section? You know, I mean, why 1975? Why New York? Why Damascus? Why these characters? Is that a good place to start, do you reckon?
Well, first of all, 1975 was the year I was born. He didn't mention that.
No.
Turn me against him already. No, seriously. I mean, it's an interesting, the New York bit's an interesting little history lesson, I suppose. Mm, and I guess this was the era where the market did take over. It's interesting to see how New York City became what it is now, which is, as I said, a city for the rich. I agree with you. I don't really know why Trump is in there necessarily. I think from the Damascus side, when I thought of Henry Kissinger, we always seem to piggyback back to previous talks, and I was thinking of Sir Humphrey.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, because Sir Humphrey and Yes Minister, he doesn't really pick a side, because he said he just has to go with the side who's ever in power. And I think, I don't know how ideological Henry Kissinger, I think you're right. It's really more divide and rule, you know, manipulate whoever's in power and try and play them against each other. So, I mean, there's interesting ideas, you know, how New York became rich, divide and rule.
Oh, sure, sure.
Logic of the market, but I'm just not clear why it's there. I don't see what...
Interesting narrative. And of course, he had to pick a particular point in history. Otherwise, he would have to explain the whole history as almost. But again, I suppose it's a fault of his method, his style. Mm-hmm. Everything is cut and dry. So it starts in 1975 and it gives that impression. But I wondered, you know, could he not have gone back further to the setting up of the Federal Reserve in 1913 as the major starting point for this kind of narrative of banking technocracy?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be the one? You know, arguably that sets in motion government unnecessarily and increasingly borrowing thin air money from elite bankers. So you could trace it back to there, couldn't you?
I think you answered your own question earlier when you said he only goes so far. Because I don't think the BBC is at all interested in telling anyone how the Federal Reserve was created.
Exactly. And that fits into what I've thought about it generally, is that he tries to explain things in terms of opportunism.
Mm.
So there you go. It's the banks. Oh, it's an opportunistic moment to take over the running of the city. But if you're talking about something like the Federal Reserve back in 1913, that's intention. So that's, oh, that's conspiracy theory territory. So
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I mean. He'll touch one of the cards in the House of Cards, but he won't ever remove the top one. You know what I mean? It's I mean, at the end of the day, it's a mainstream. BBC is a mainstream organisation. Or a mainstream documentary has some alternative ideas, but it's in a mainstream framework. You know, he's probably not going to deviate from that.
No. And on the same line, he mentions technocracy, actually, at this point, a couple of times.
Right.
And again, it's this sort of opportunism of the bank. He doesn't mention the fact that technocracy goes back to the 1930s and has a philosophical pedigree going back to the Enlightenment. When Martin Erdmann's been on this show talking about Henri Saint-Simon, Auguste Comte, you know, way back. He doesn't mention the Trilateral Commission, who kept the idea going in the 1970s, and Pat Wood's been on talking about that. And it occurred to me is, you know, is it a coincidence that, say, David Rockefeller, who co-founded the Trilateral Commission, was a major figure in the banking world, a CEO of Chase Manhattan Bank. There's that link there, isn't there, between the ideology of technocracy and the banking world. That doesn't get a mention. Is that because that would be conspiracy territory again? I think that's
what it is at the end of the day.
So those are all the reasons why I feel this starting in the middle of the 70s is sort of artificial and interesting, really interesting what happened there, but it's a bit one-dimensional.
Do they not talk about the Soviet Empire and hypernormalization in this section?
It is. You're right. Inside the Soviet Empire. Yeah.
And what you said right at the beginning, hypernormalization refers to the Soviet Empire, the idea that nothing really makes sense and no one's in control and it's all crumbling, but everyone goes along with it because they can't see an alternative. And I think, you know, again, you could apply that to the American Empire, surely, you know. I mean, do you remember have you ever heard the famous quote? I think it's John Pilger who quoted it. Some journalists from communist Russia came to America during the communist era, maybe the 70s. And after a few days, they said, it's amazing. Everybody just does exactly what you want them to do. But in Soviet Russia, we have to threaten them with death. But here they seem to do it voluntarily. And I mean, I don't mean to equate modern day America with Soviet Russia, because I don't think they're comparable. But just that idea of sort of hidden control, I think, was interesting.
Mm.
They talk about a book called Roadside Picnic, which I'd quite like to read now, having seen this.
Yes.
And it talks about an alien zone where reality changes minute by minute, a shifting and unstable situation where hidden forces twist your reality. I mean, that's a fairly good summation of the modern world, I suppose.
It sort of seemed to fit.
Well, yeah.
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 Okay, the next one is the section is the human bomb. So this is about suicide bombing. All right, I think too much is made of this. So we move now to 1981. Ronald Reagan comes in. So the picture then is of a simpler, more positive USA mission for the world. Syria is still very angry. Okay, so Israel let the Palestinian massacre happen. Reagan is intent on a peacekeeping force to the Lebanon. Quite how much it's just a peacekeeping force, don't know. Okay, so Syria saw this as a USA/Israeli conspiracy. So Assad then a bit paranoid about this, and brackets, perhaps understandable, close brackets, not sure. He made a pact with the Ayatollah Khomeini, and Khomeini had this, what was referred to in the film as the poor man's atomic bomb, which was suicide warfare. And the point's made that the Quran prohibits suicide, but Khomeini changed the Shia Islamic ritual of self-flagellation into a kind of hyper-flagellation, so you could kill yourself for the revolution as an ultimate penance. That's an interesting thing that he should do that, so actually go against the Quran by a bit of sophistry there. But I mean, dreadful what he says about it. This idea was mobilized during the Iraq-Iran war, and thousands of young men and boys essentially were sent into minefields as sort of organized suicide squads to open up minefield areas. I mean, just absolutely awful. And they show cemeteries with fountains of colored water looking like blood. I mean, just absolutely disgusting. But it goes on to say that Assad took this idea of suicide warfare from Khomeini, and it became suicide bombing. And we have the example of the US Marine base in Beirut being bombed by Hezbollah, and they were under the direction of Assad, we're told. So Assad comes out of this pretty badly, as indeed does Kissinger. Now, at this point in the narrative, then Reagan gets out of the Lebanon, and the narrative goes, they thought they could control this situation, but they couldn't. So this goes for both sides, really. The US thought they could control things, but they pull out. Assad thought they could control this new force, but actually turns out they couldn't. And we'll find out later on that this becomes a kind of force in its own right. It becomes perhaps more destructive than was ever anticipated. Interesting. But what do you reckon about this suicide bombing narrative here?
I mean, I wouldn't know about the stuff that he's talking about, but didn't he claim at some point that they almost invented it? Or did I get that wrong?
I think what he said was, he was quite careful the way he worded it, that it was a new force as something against the West. I think that was the point that was made. Although, sometimes the way he words things gives the impression that he is saying something along those lines.
I seem to pick that up the first time I watched this, but I watched it twice, sort of a few months apart. I can't remember the second time.
I mean, when I first watched it, I thought, well, you know, you're saying this is new in some sense, but what about kamikaze pilots in World War II? That was against the West.
Yeah, Chinese suicide.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I looked at the Wikipedia article about this, and there's a photograph there of a Chinese suicide bomber wearing a grenade vest from 1938. But I mean, particularly the kamikaze one from World War II, that's somebody in charge of an aeroplane, which effectively is a bomb, and it is against Western troops.
Yeah.
So even saying it's brought against the West for the first time, it's this simplification again, isn't it?
I mean, how does it join on from the previous part? Are we supposed to... That's the big question. Are we supposed to see this as I'm confused already?
Well, this is the trouble with it. I think this is the complexity of the world sort of thing, isn't it? Getting out of hand. Mm. I think he's showing this complexity and instability growing here.
Yeah.
And it's all part then of people not knowing how to cope with this. And so the world of politics ends up being management rather than dealing with real problems. Mm. And so we see the US in this narrative turn to people like Gaddafi to make him into a fake villain because he's easier to deal with. That sort of thing, isn't it? That's where it goes.
And I mean, do you think he's implying that the US had some understanding of the Middle East or not? Because I think that's the big thing.
I think he says that they didn't really understand the Middle East very well. Right. But I think he over-eggs that pudding, as we say here in the north of England. I think this is often said, but I think they understand a lot better than given credit for. This is kind of this plausible deniability thing. Oh, they didn't realise what was going to happen. You know, they didn't realise that Libya was going to go into chaos. Oh, they didn't realise Iraq was going to go into chaos, etc., etc. They weren't ready. Sorry, I don't really buy it. I think they do know what's going to happen. It justifies continual war and imperial occupation, etc.
I mean, I think it was quite effective how brutal the Middle East situation is. I mean, Have you ever tried to plough through Robert Fisk's book, The War on Civilization?
I haven't, no.
I mean, it's a 1,000-page book. I read probably about 100 pages, but, I mean, it is rough.
Right.
Not his writing, I mean, what he's talking about. I mean, he knows his stuff, of course.
It's a tough, tough area of the world, for sure.
And, I mean, it's something we don't understand. And, of course, in the mainstream, they're never going to really mention oil, are they, at all? I mean, that's...
Right.
Yeah, I don't know what Adam Curtis thinks is the reason we're in the Middle East. I'd quite like to ask him that. I don't know what side he'd be on. But yeah, again, on its own as a little section, pretty interesting. Where it follows on from the previous one, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I think it doesn't so much. I think it's a break.
Chronologically, it does. Chronologically, it does, I guess.
And chronologically, but he's introducing a new element, and those elements move onward to what he wants to say later. So he's setting up the condition of chaos, which is then reacted to later by trying to manage the situation rather than deal with the situation, to manage it. I think that's because the whole thing is thesis, isn't it, of kind of the managerial class takes over. Politics is dead kind of thing. Well, I've got sections 3 and 4 together here. Altered States and Acid Flashback, because they seem to deal with highly related things. So this is bringing in the theme of technology in connection with all this. So we have banks and corporations becoming increasingly networked, and that's hidden as far as ordinary people are concerned. It's nevertheless happening. We have the novelist William Gibson introduced here, who invented the cyberpunk genre of science fiction, apparently. And the theme that comes out in his work is that politicians can't save you. Raw corporate power controls. And then he says, and this is one of Adam Curtis's stock techniques, he says, but then a strange thing happened.
Oh yeah, he always says that, doesn't he?
And everything gets turned upside down. Right, yeah, it's one way and now it's another way. So the utopians took that vision and they turned it upside down, and these are the technological utopians, and they reinvented the vision of a new safe world where dreams could come true. So cyberspace then, this alternate reality connected to the, you know, sort of 1960s countercultural roots, alternative world sort of thing, connects to LSD and all that. But it was looked upon in a very positive way, a liberating way, rather than this, you know, raw corporate power in control. No, this is power to the people. And John Perry Barlow is brought in. So he wrote songs of the Grateful Dead in the 1960s. And he organized things called cyberthons. He created a manifesto called Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace in the mid-90s. And this is apparently sent to politicians. He founded the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. So this is the whole idea of the internet as a free space, liberating space, a sovereign space, in fact. And we get footage there from the film Tron, which I've still not seen, but
I've seen that one, yeah. It's good.
And then we get this weird thing about the two young cult figures, hackers in New York, Fiber Optic and Acid Freak, from a hacker group called Masters of Deception. And they hacked into a credit rating network, and they stole John Perry Barlow's credit history to show that, in fact, the financial world had much more power than anybody realized. And you could declare as much as you like that it's a free internet, but actually it's vulnerable to control. And they showed that it really was not a utopia. But did it have, does it have merits? I certainly think so. And I'm wondering whether Curtis perhaps downplays the merits and power of the internet in this narrative. Because the narrative link at that point is, but cyberspace was not the only imaginary story being created. Yeah. Well, cyberspace isn't an imaginary story, is it? It's real. It's a virtual reality, but it is a real virtual reality and it has real effects in the world. And I dispute that it is a feat.
Yeah.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, I thought the two views of the computer systems was interesting. Yeah, you can't really argue with that the internet does have those two aspects. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the internet can produce real results. You know, if you use the internet, as we'll see near the end of this documentary, if you use the internet to set up a protest, for example, then when you get together, the protest is real. It's not a virtual protest.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And he does actually mention this later, doesn't he, with the Arab Spring, that we can talk about what are the causes of the Arab Spring. And that's, again, he hides the role of the CIA and all that, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, there you have it, real effects of the online world. And you have to say, why is there all this business about fake news and deplatforming people and all this kind of thing? It's because there is the fear in the establishment that, in fact, the internet is extremely powerful. So, you know, I don't think Curtis's narrative works there at all. I think he's wrong about that.
Yeah, I think this kind of, well, you know what they call agents provocateurs, which are people who go to peaceful protests dressed up as the protesters and then start causing trouble.
Yes.
I think, you know, with trolls and everything on the internet, I think that's a reality.
Oh, it must be.
So, I would agree with you. I think the establishment, if there's a they, I guess there is. Mm. Yeah, they are worried about it. Of course, then the argument is, why don't they shut it down? I mean, there must be a way where they could almost, well, not shut it down, obviously. Yes. More of a sort of boiling frog thing, you know, just gradually.
It's because we live in this world, the whole structure of the so-called free world is the illusion of freedom, democracy, blah, blah, blah. You can't just jump on all of that, can you, and bring that all to an end.
Mm.
That's the way it's structured. And it actually works very well for people in positions of power and great wealth. It does work well, so long as they keep that delicate balance of illusion going. So they can't do that. They therefore have to neutralize it in a way that is more conducive to that illusion.
Yeah, but I mean, it's so much of it is psychological, like I'm always saying, you know, it's how you, if you're discerning, you can use social media only for positive ends, I believe.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I always think of an analogy of when alcoholics go to Alcoholics Anonymous, they always say, like, you're 50% there if you admit you're an alcoholic. And if we admit that we're being propagandized and we recognize it, then we've got more chance of not being affected by it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's
I do.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's making these sweeping statements, but it really does depend. I don't know what he thinks the average person, how malleable he thinks the average person is. I
get the impression he thinks that most people are infinitely malleable, the way he speaks about people. Nobody knew, nobody cared, nobody understood, etc. Even if you take that as hyperbole, which it clearly is, nevertheless, you must at least mean the majority of people went along with it, or the majority of people didn't care, etc. So,
I suppose that's an improvement on everyone went along with it.
Well, it is. But I'm just saying he must at least have a pretty negative view of people's perception of such matters, generally.
Yeah, I would say so. What do you think about the link between LSD and cyberspace? I'm not totally convinced about that. I know it's the idea of sort of freedom. It fits in with the general thing of freedom.
I thought, yeah, sort of, but I thought it was more the going inward and finding a fake reality element of it.
Okay.
So again, I think that was a rather negative slant on the whole thing, so I was a bit disappointed by that. I suppose, yeah, people do use the internet for just dwelling inside a fake reality and ignoring the world. I'm sure that happens, which is what LSD is. So there is a link there, but
I thought it was a bit weird because LSD is really to do with nature and being natural, and people who take it, they go out into nature. They wouldn't be in a room on a computer.
No, but they're kind of going inside their own head, aren't they? Certainly from my perspective, I would say they are having a fake experience of transcendence. It's not real transcendence at all. They're still here. But their perception of reality is so changed that they think they're having a real transcendence. And by analogy, you can use the internet in the same kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that'd be a discussion for another day, because I think a lot of people argue that psychedelics take you out of a fake reality into something more real, but I think that's a discussion for another day.
I'm sure they do. This is Timothy Leary and stuff, isn't it? Yeah, but yeah, well, that's a kind of a worldview thing. I see that as kind of parallel to some forms of Eastern meditation as well, which again I think is a fake transcendence, because I don't think you actually do transcend the world that way. Which is not to say that I'm criticizing the motivation. I think the desire to transcend the world is a good thing, because if we're just limited to this world, then we're just matter and basically robots, etc. So yeah, to be rooted in something transcendent I think is very important, but I don't think you do it that way. But as you say, that's a discussion for a different day.
Yeah, I mean, I think LSD and meditation, I think they just change the way you view the world. So you can go about your normal day, but you might have a slightly changed view of it. But no, I thought that section was quite interesting. I like the phrase raw, brutal corporate power, because that sort of spoke to me. He's quite effective at talking about how brutal a system can be.
Yes.
When you program it to do a certain thing, it's like it'll go, it won't have any feelings about it. I mean, he's on to something with talking about this fake world and everything, but again, it's too
he's on to technocracy. He does mention it a few times.
Yeah,
I wish he mentioned it more, but I guess that if he did use the word consistently throughout, he would then have to go into the history of technocracy, and that will bring him into the conspiracy territory, so he avoids that. But he is on to technocracy, and I think that is a real threat. Exactly the kind of thing you just said, a robotic world where everything works really efficiently. but it doesn't care about, doesn't fundamentally care about persons. Mm. It does what's best for the system. And that's pretty frightening.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the problem with him is maybe that he sort of spews out so many different things that if he wanted to like deep dive into everything he talks about, he'd probably need about 10 hours.
Yeah.
I watched the film again in one go and was absolutely exhausted by the end of it. I kind of thought it's almost like a compilation package, you know? Mm. It's a little bit from here and a little bit from here and a little bit from here.
Yeah.
But there's not enough deep dive, I don't think.
No, he's bitten off more than he can chew.
I think
people will get that from this conversation. Anybody who's not seen it will be thinking, what on earth are they talking about? They're chopping and changing from one thing to another. Well, we have to, because that's what the documentary does.
Yeah.
But I think people will get from our conversation just how fascinating a documentary is with all these nuggets that do individually need that 10 hours of explication.
Yeah.
And so we're both saying, go and watch it, because it is really interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, listeners who've come this far, please don't feel like we're trashing it too much, because we're not. You know, it's there to be dissected, and I wouldn't dismiss it as much as the quote that you read earlier.
I totally agree. I read that because I thought that was a very effective and quite amusing quote, but it went too far, definitely.
No, I understand. Yeah, no, I understand why you read it.
And anybody who's come this far, I have to say, is an elite member of the TMR audience.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
We've been talking for 3 days, listeners. You didn't realise that, did you? We've edited it down. No, it's a joke.
We've been talking for an hour and a half. I don't know how much that's going to come out in the final edit. Do you want to move on to The Colonel? Because this is...
Yeah, I think we should.
I think we both agree this is one of the best parts of it, isn't it? When Colonel Gaddafi is brought into the narrative, and he fits nicely into the narrative, unlike Trump. Okay, so the US needed a new villain. The West needed a new villain after pulling out of Lebanon. So they were kind of free of the real Middle Eastern politics. But, you know, what do you do then? So Gaddafi then becomes the perfect villain to use him as a fake terror mastermind. And the amazing thing is that Gaddafi likes this because it brings him fame and recognition. And you can see that, can't you, in the clips they show of him. He does in fact quite like this and thinks this is an opportunity. So we get the backstory about Gaddafi here, that he led a coup in the 1970s, came to power. He believed in an international revolution to challenge the power of the West, to challenge the status quo, and he has this theory called the Third Universal Theory, which is published in a green book. I actually have a copy of that book, Anthony. Can you believe that?
Wow.
On my desk here. It's called Revolution, Tragic Necessity, and somebody called Y.N. Clye. Is he the translator? I'm not sure. This is the March 1984 edition.
And this is Gaddafi's answer. So the first two are communism and fascism, is that right?
You've got communism and capitalism, essentially.
Oh, sorry, right.
And so this is a third way.
Oh, I see.
Which neatly dovetails with the third way of Tony Blair.
Oh, yeah,
I've read bits of it. It's very boring. It's in that typical style of the Marxist-Leninist treaties. Some interesting thoughts and critiques, but it doesn't, as far as I can see anyway, it doesn't really hold together as a theory.
How long is a book? Is that of interest?
Oh, it's very short.
Oh.
But nevertheless, it's difficult to plow through because it is so boring. But as I say, that's typical of this kind of thing. I tried to read some of Enver Hoxha's works once, and I went to sleep. 62 pages. But if they were normal pages, I would say it would be about 30 pages long.
Blimey.
Anyway, not many people read this book, and he was quite isolated in the 1980s. But, of course, then when he becomes this terror mastermind, then his fame expands. So we have in the middle 1980s, Rome, I think, and Vienna airports were attacked.
Yeah, airport attacks,
Yeah, people were killed. Reagan announced, I mean, that's just Reagan announcing what he's been told, but Reagan announced it, that Libya had backed these, but the security services in Europe, Italy particularly, blamed Syria, not Libya.
Right.
There's an interview with a US official at the time, and you know, he doesn't want to agree. The interviewer is saying, oh, you know, but the Europeans say it was Syria, and this particular official has no evidence, just sort of says, no, well, we know we have intelligence to say that it clearly was Libya, you know, but they really didn't have anything. That was obvious from the interview. But Gaddafi didn't deny it, and he makes this global drama out of it and threatens suicide attacks against the US, promoted himself as a liberator globally. And there's this amazing footage of him appealing to the Nation of Islam in the US. And now he's their ally in the struggle against white America, and he would perhaps even supply weapons for a big army inside the US, and he's even started to posture to explore space.
Mm.
But, you know, basically he's painted by the West as a supervillain of a rogue state.
Mm.
And I thought it was really fascinating. There was an interview with Gaddafi that they showed around the time, and he clearly liked the fact that he's asked the question, you know, what do you think of the fact that people are afraid of you? And he smiles. He clearly likes it. So funny guy, has to be said. Certainly a funny chap.
I mean, they're playing to sort of his ego and the sort of fame as a drug, aren't they?
Mm.
There's an argument to say that most people who become leaders must probably got fairly large egos.
Mm.
Fame is a drug, you know, like lots of other drugs. I think they just picked the right guy, really. And the thing is that the fact that he didn't dispute it and he played along with it, it negates the need to really come up with any good evidence. And as we've said, and Adam Curtis said, simplicity is easier, you know?
Yeah. And I think the point he makes here, which fits in with his thesis really well, is that both Gaddafi and the US together were creating a fake drama between them, a fake war. So the US was saying Gaddafi is this great master villain, and Gaddafi was saying, yeah, basically, I'm a great master villain, and it's not really true from either side.
Yeah.
But it suits their purposes to go along with this. I thought that was fascinating.
I thought the bit was interesting where, like, as you were saying, I think it was a discotheque attack as well in Berlin.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, and the European Security Services are pretty sure it was Syria.
That's it.
And I think the State Department official said something like, we have strong circumstantial evidence. But he just sort of sounded confident.
Yeah.
But I thought it was very interesting. I think there's a congressman, and I've got the quote here. The American people are tired of being kicked around. You talk tough. Are you going to use those billions of dollars of weapons we've approved? Mm. It's the idea. I mean, George Carlin used to say that war is really a comparison of sizes. So, you know, I mean, it's definitely Dr. Strangelove, you know, the sexual analogy of war.
Well, yeah, and if you are trying to do stuff in the world and control things, then you can't control the Middle East because it's too difficult, it's too dodgy, etc. But it makes sense that Gaddafi becomes a softer target.
Mm.
He's got less Arab support, less Soviet support.
Mm.
He's a good one to pick.
Yeah.
And if he likes it as well, that's even better. He plays along with it.
Yeah, so I think the takeoff from that is, yeah, they kind of got the right guy, you know, guy with a big ego, chuck a bit of fame his way. Maybe he wants to be seen as a bit of a bad boy. Yeah, very interesting. I enjoyed that. Enjoyed that part. And then Gaddafi sort of appears again a couple of times, doesn't he?
He does. Well, we'll come to that. I just wanted to...
we'll come to that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wanted to mention a couple of things to sort of learn from this, at least what I take from it. This whole narrative of fake enemies, I think, is important. You know that I used to listen to, and indeed did interview, Stanley Monteith, and one of his mantras was, it's the best enemy that money can buy, you know? Mm. And he used to make, as so many people make the point, that the military-industrial complex, military-security complex, whatever you want to call it, does need enemies to justify its existence. It's a machine. It needs to keep running.
Mm.
It needs to be seen to be doing something. So if it needs to choose a softer target because the real thing is too hard, then so be it. It doesn't want the funding to disappear. A lot of people say that the Soviet threat, although it was real, was nevertheless exaggerated. Mm. At the moment, we have the threat of Iran being exaggerated, Syria, of course, we had the Iraq threat was completely drummed up. And of course, the threat from ISIS was always exaggerated, wasn't it? They never really had any realistic hope of a caliphate stretching from Asia to Spain. And yet, as it was in the news, you know, oh dear, around the time of all that beheading that was going on.
Mm.
And indeed, as Curtis makes the point, you know, in that documentary we were talking about before, Al-Qaeda was exaggerated. Well, what is Al-Qaeda?
Tom Secker did a series about Al-Qaeda, though, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah, I didn't listen to all of it. But
yeah, I'm not trying to say that. I mean, James Corbett created a documentary called Al-Qaeda Doesn't Exist.
He didn't finish it, though.
But that was... No, he didn't. But I think the point he was making was a similar one to what Curtis makes, that Al-Qaeda as a coherent organisation never really existed.
Mm.
As a kind of meme that can float around in the media such that we are frightened of this octopus with tentacles reaching everywhere across the world. Well, that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, in that sense, the sense of the fake enemy about it.
Yeah. I mean, there probably are groups. Mm. It's not a bunch of random jihadists either, is it?
No, sure.
And I mean, for the sake of fairness...
No, I'm going to just say, but don't you think that the way the term has been used over the years does connote this really coherent organisation that is this great threat against which we are at war in the War of Terror.
Mm.
I don't really buy that.
Yeah.
As a kind of black and white situation, it's easy to sell to the public and justify war. I don't really buy it like that. And I think that was the point that Curtis and Corbett were making.
Yeah, but isn't it a bit easy to say that Al-Qaeda doesn't exist as well?
It's hyperbole, isn't it? It's hyperbole.
Yeah. Because I do remember, just a slight tangent, on that Power of Nightmares, there's a fellow called Jason Burke, who's a terrorism expert, and he's one of the big money quotes that the alternative media uses. He says, Al-Qaeda as a coherent thing doesn't exist.
Yep.
I've actually listened to a couple of his speeches, which are on YouTube, and I mean, he didn't necessarily go back on it, but I think, again, that quote, the alt media is a bit guilty of taking quotes, as any documentary probably are, of taking things slightly out of context. So yeah. I think it's somewhere in the middle, obviously, but I would agree.
I think we're both saying the same thing.
Yeah. I would agree that it's not as coherent as an organization.
Well, another thing to throw in there is, if one does accept an alternative view of what happened on 9/11, then one would have to ask, well, what does Al-Qaeda mean at that point? You know, if you've got jihadists being directed by people from the inside, as it seems that was the case, then are not those people directing from the inside Al-Qaeda? Mm. See what I mean? Mm. At that point, it becomes difficult to define what you're talking about.
Yeah, and the argument is, how many people would it take to put together that attack, or at least turning a blind eye? I mean,
well, surely at least turning a blind eye, but isn't turning a blind eye, doesn't that make you part of it?
Well, exactly. Yeah.
And if you could have done otherwise, then that makes you Al-Qaeda, doesn't it? You see what I mean?
Yeah.
It becomes difficult to define quite what that term means.
Yeah.
But in the mainstream, that's not an acceptable definition of Al-Qaeda, because it doesn't fit the narrative wherein which Al-Qaeda's black and we're white.
Mm. Yeah.
So in that sense, Al-Qaeda doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I think that's the point that's being made.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like you said, it's simple. Mm. It's simple. I was just thinking, didn't they mention the US invasion of Libya? Was that in this section, 1986?
It was. Yes, that's right.
And he did say that they chose them as a soft target as opposed to Syria. Which, again, I mean, that's a good point. You know, that's for a mainstream documentary, that's quite a telling point, I would say.
And we mustn't forget, talking about this creation of fake enemies things, is this is what we see and have been seeing for quite a while with Russia.
Mm.
So much of this narrative against Russia and Putin, somebody called it a cloud of accusations the other day, this accumulating cloud of accusations.
Mm.
So much of it is implausible. Mm. It seems to me to be a new enemy. Well, it's not a new enemy, but, you know, a resurrection of an old enemy in connection with various geopolitical goals across the Middle East, Syria.
And sort of doing nonsensical things as well, like with Assad, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know whether we're supposed to think he's stupid or he's crazy. I don't know. But there's so much lack of logic to his actions.
He's just evil, I think, is the idea. Yeah,
he's
evil. But as I've said so many times, if he's evil, he would also have to be stupid, or he would have to be insane as well. So it still doesn't make sense. And the things that Putin is supposed to, you know, this Novichok business, fundamentally doesn't make sense to me. However much the story is, of course, you know, there's accumulation of supposed evidence after supposed evidence that's building after the event to make it almost impossible to disbelieve the official narrative about it. I think that's the way these things work. You know, the story starts off really implausible. Lots of people disbelieve it, but then they keep piling on the supposed evidence. And so eventually you start to think, perhaps it was right after all. I think that's modus operandi, really. But fundamentally, I see that as just another one of these stories to create a fake enemy, essentially.
Yeah, you're right about the MO, although in the case of the death of Bin Laden, it was almost the opposite, wasn't it? Because they seemed to start with a fairly fixed narrative, like he'd use his wife as a shield and things, and then the story got more and more implausible, so they kind of went the opposite way in that way.
No, I disagree. I see what you mean. In the first days, but I think they were kind of patching things up, because I thought it was quite implausible to start with.
Right.
You see various strands of the story unravelling, but in the days since, I mean, we've had, obviously, the constant repetition of the fact that it happened, the constant demonisation of everybody who thinks that he died before that event, and the publication of documents supposedly found there, interviews with members of the family, interviews with people who supposedly or claim to have shot him, etc. I get the impression that there must be a bit of an industry creating documents that supposedly came from that compound. Now, there will be some people hearing me say that who think, oh, good heavens, do you really believe that?
Mm.
Now, what I'm saying is, look at the power of accumulating supposed data to reinforce a fundamentally false narrative. It is extremely powerful. You initially think it's false. Everything about it, your intuition tells you this is nonsense. But if in the years thereafter they publish things that came from the compound, then you find yourself thinking, oh, well, maybe. And it's the same thing with this Novichok thing. How many people disbelieved it to start with? But now we've had this strange interview with the two supposed individuals who carried it out, which is a mystery in itself, I agree. It's very difficult to interpret that. But nevertheless, you know, it's evidence that has now supposedly confirmed the mainstream narrative. It's been pulled out of the hat one way or another.
Yeah.
I mean, were they dupes? Were they individuals who had shady dealings and they were lured into the area deliberately as part of the operation? You know what I mean? It's very difficult to interpret what's going on there. But it's possible this is part of the same sort of accumulation effect to support a fake narrative.
Yeah, when there's such a mountain of evidence, it becomes harder to deny it, I suppose.
It does.
Yeah. Mm. So how are we getting on? Because
we're about halfway, aren't we?
I was just thinking we're still not very far through this film. Could we do one more section and then maybe do it another day? Because I feel like I'm tripping over my words a bit.
Sure. Well, the next section is The Truth is Out There. Actually, I'm wondering whether we should leave that, because that feels like a big change to a completely different subject, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, about UFOs and all of that.
Mm.
I mean, it fits into the narrative of this creating something fake to deal with difficulties. It's an instance of perception management.
Yeah.
I see how that fits, but it brings up a lot of questions, because Curtis treats this as a real attempt to create something fake, but that's a bit of a moot point, actually, a huge moot point. I think we probably need to go into that next time, don't you think?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there then. So the next section that we're going to talk about next time, we're roughly halfway through, is this section called The Truth is Out There, where he shifts, interestingly, but rather oddly, to the whole business about ufology, UFO sightings in the 1980s, and what the role might have been with the US government in manipulating people's perceptions of what they believe to be UFO sightings. Quite an interesting thing, but I have problems with this section, which we'll talk about next time. We'll start with this one, and we'll have a fresh start, won't we? when we talk about this. So we're about halfway through the documentary. So this particular podcast will go out in two sections. So I look forward to speaking to you again, Anthony, in a couple of days or so.
Yeah,
well, more than that, actually, a few days from now. We finish this off. Thanks ever so much for having this conversation.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And we are recommending it, aren't we? Repeat that one. As something to watch.
Yes, and please listen to part two. Plenty more good stuff.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'll speak to you in a few days, Anthony, and all the best.
Okay, you too. Bye. Now we carry on.